Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Steve Goldstein. You're listening to the show with help today from our partners at The World. It's a time of giving and a time of sharing with those who are less fortunate. In a recent interview with KJZZ, Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton said he's focused on working with those who are near the brink of homelessness to provide them with a safety net.
There are a lot of people that are homeless that aren't living on the streets. They're couch hopping, they're staying with friends, et cetera. They don't have housing stability. If you don't have housing stability, you're not going to have educational stability. You're not going to have stability in your health, in your relationships. I mean, housing stability is the rock upon which often the rest of your life is built. You got to have that to have so many other things in your life. So that's exactly what I want to do, is to provide people housing stability, to indicate people that are on the brink of homelessness, make sure that we have systems in place so that they can come forward and say, we're about to lose our home, and then they have a safe landing, that they don't end up on the streets or in a shelter. We want to avoid that. We want to get them into permanent supportive housing as soon as possible.
However, one potential revenue stream for those suffering from housing instability may soon dry up. Last week, the Phoenix City Council passed a new ordinance that seeks to eliminate panhandling near intersections and city streets. Described as a traffic safety measure, those who would solicit money or panhandle in the medians of Phoenix will now be subject to fines and a misdemeanor. In light of this development, I spoke with Mark Holleran of Central Arizona Shelter Services to discuss the potential impacts.
My sense is that most of the individuals that we serve here at the Cache Shelter are not the individuals that your listeners might encounter when pulling off the freeways or, parked at a red light, waiting for the signal to change. Whenever I've attempted this in the past to personally engage people at the corners and at the stoplights, at the freeway interchanges, And I don't believe, just from personal experience, that those are the people that I serve. They've been reluctant to engage with me. And, you know, I'm sure that your listeners are asked, you know, I need money for a bus ticket or I need money for food or whatnot. And when I've offered to give them the bus ticket or take them to get food, almost all the time they decline that sort of assistance. And so that usually is my sort of first indicator to say perhaps they're here at the corner for other reasons. The people that we are serving, for the most part, are trying to move out of the condition of homelessness, and they're trying to, you know, be directly involved with accessing resources that they can count on an ongoing basis.
Mark, in a broader sense, a little over a year ago, the city of Phoenix announced plans to do the best it could and really be a leader in getting chronically homeless vets off the streets and into more stable housing situation. From your point of view, in general, do you think Phoenix, the Valley, is a real progressive place when it comes to having good ideas about how to improve the situation for homeless people?
I think Phoenix is doing an excellent job. You know, we have relatively scarce resources, and we seem to try harder, in my opinion. And I think what we've done as a community, move closer to getting a little more technical as far as assessing people's needs and then applying those very scarce resources to the individuals that need it most. We're on a path to be much more effective and much more targeted about how we invest these scarce resources. And I think we're starting to see the payoff, especially as it relates to chronically homeless vets.
Mark Holleran is the CEO of Central Arizona Shelter Services. Black Friday has been dominated by a lot of the big box stores, with sales you can only get if you stand in line outside for hours. Now, some nonprofits are trying their own approach. The Phoenix Art Museum, for one, is opening early at 8 a.m. and offering free annual memberships to the first 55 non-members who show up. Patricia Lewis of ASU's Lodestar Center for Philanthropy and Nonprofit Innovation says it's a good idea for nonprofits to piggyback on the Black Friday concept.
Yes, I think that's exactly what's happening. And for some nonprofits, it would work really well. The Phoenix Art Museum is a classic example. It has a wonderful store, and people can get in and see the exhibits and have a marvelous time. That's not related to the shopping, and it's not related to what, let's call the word commercialism, that was so evident early on, as evidenced by Black Friday and Cyber Monday.
Even though it's non-commercialization. Do you think it can work in the same way in the sense of getting people excited about that as opposed to, you know, here's a big mattress sale or you can get a big screen TV?
I'm not certain you'd get the same level of excitement. I think what it's doing is trying to tune into the kind of sharing and caring that is a part of our culture and always has been. And I think it's trying to tune in there for especially for those who are beginning to sense that we're over-commercializing the holiday season. It's important, I think, that nonprofits that have that opportunity do this so that people begin to see that there's more to the holiday season than buying gifts. The holiday season is really meant to be a season of sharing and caring and looking after one another, which is one of the reasons why Giving Tuesday was developed. And Giving Tuesday was developed by 92nd Street Y in New York. Mm. And then the United Nations Foundation joined in, and it became this overnight success of people finding a way to express their desire to share in ways that are other than buying gifts, but perhaps giving their time in addition to giving gifts.
Going forward, when it comes to the nonprofit concept, whether it's with a museum or whether it's Giving Tuesday or whatever it may be, based on the trends you're seeing, are we eventually going to see the tides shift? Are we eventually going to see the weight leaning one way or the other? Or do we see Black Friday just being such a dominant force and Cyber Monday that basically, even at our core selves, it's going to be about shopping?
My thought on it is that Giving Tuesday and all that that means will begin to carry a greater sense of weight and interest by people, especially with the younger generations. It is an anomaly of the social media. And so I think we will see more of that, and we will see increased activity and increased interest in what Giving Tuesday is all about. I'm not sure it will significantly impact shopping. I think it will be something in addition.
Patricia Lewis of ASU's Lodestar Center for Philanthropy and Nonprofit Innovation. You're listening to The Show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Doug Topham, and I own the Christmas Light Decorators, and we're the company that Glendale contracts with to install the lights for Glendale Glitters. We use 22 different employees on this job, and 6 bucket trucks and 3 lifts. If we put all the strands end to end, it's about 142 miles. We've got about 9 tons of extension cords here, which is, I think, around 7.5 miles of extension cords. We can program the entire tree. We can program every single bulb to be different, or to change, or to stay the same. I could sit home on my laptop over the internet and change the colors of the park.
That's Doug Topham and crew putting up Christmas lights in downtown Glendale for Glendale Glitters at Murphy Park in Glendale. The lights flash on tomorrow night. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, just send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. Good afternoon. It's The Show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein.
An artist best known for massive steel and concrete sculptures has an exhibit of smaller pieces in Phoenix. The Mexican-born Sebastian has done pieces around the world, including in Japan, Mexico, and the U.S., and now has a show at Bentley Gallery in conjunction with the Mexican Consulate in Phoenix. I spoke with Sebastian and his daughter, Gabriela Carbajal, who translated for him, and asked him to describe his art.
Yo describo lo que yo hago como...
I describe what I do as a Sebastian-esque essence, a language that I've created by myself. My idea is to use a geometric language in order to express my artistic senses and create a personal language.
Where do you get your inspirations?
La inspiración yo considero de todos los
I consider that the inspiration for my work as of the most of the artists in the world is nature. I refer to microcosmic and macrocosmic nature, total nature of the universe. Every artist uses this nature and picks different parts in order to translate whatever they want to say to the world and what they're interested in. It could be either something that is like a formal nature that has more to do with the body, has to do more with the minerals. It just depends on what they're interested in and what they want to tell the world by their work.
Mineral o vegetal o que no, sí, okay.
When you look at a landscape or when you look at something in nature, do you think that you see it differently than other people?
No, yo creo que todos los seres humanos tenemos.
I believe that we all have the same basic way of looking at landscapes and looking at nature. But when you are more sensible or you have this artistic touch, you tend to see a little bit beyond that in order to be inspired.
Cosas profundamente.
Most of your pieces are very, very big. Are the ones in this show replicas of them? Are they drawings or paintings, or what are they?
Es verdad que mi obra.
It is true that a lot of my work is monumental. I have lots of things with that great scale, but there's also a lot of work that I have, such as the quantic pieces that are smaller structures.
Are you somebody who, when you were younger, was very interested in math and science? It sounds like a lot of your work is sort of based on math and science.
Sí, desde niño yo tengo una vocación.
Ever since I was little, I was interested in space, in the topology, in the geometry of things, and it has been there since I was small. With a profound intuition that has taken me to develop this spatial intuition, to develop this language.
Espacial.
The artist Sebastian, with his daughter Gabriella, translating. The exhibit of his work will be on display at Bentley Gallery in Phoenix through mid-January.
It's the show on KJZZ. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Steve Goldstein. You may have seen last week's New York Times article, The United States of Thanksgiving. It features a Thanksgiving recipe that evokes the unique flavors of each state. And the recipe for Arizona is a cranberry sauce with chilies. Not bad, but we figured there was a lot more we could do to spice up our Turkey Day table. So I spoke with Karen Zoldan, who has a blog called Circle of Food, about ways to add more Southwestern flavor to a traditional meal.
Some people like to smoke turkeys. They could use mesquite chips. So that would give the turkey an extra smoky flavor. Another thing might be they could add prickly pear puree if they make their own cranberry sauce, or perhaps put it in an apple pie just to add a little bit of Southwest color, that beautiful magenta that prickly pear is, or just a little flavor. In Tucson, we have a fabulous brewery called Borderlands Brewery, and they make a mesquite smoked Scottish ale. And of course, you could drink it, but I think it might be interesting if you baste the turkey or brine the turkey in it as part of the liquid. And something that I think I'm going to make, I'm going to a potluck, and I'm going to roast sweet potatoes and carrots, and I'm probably going to add some poblano chilies. And then when it comes out of the oven, I will drizzle balsamic vinegar on it, and before it's served, some pomegranate seeds, because then it'll be, you know, really pretty colors and have that Southwest flair.
And now, Karen, one of the things that's a staple for some, though they vary what they put in it, is stuffing. Anything come to mind as far as Southwest stuffing?
Well, I'm glad you asked because, this isn't typically Arizona. Of course, it's New Mexico, and we must always embrace New Mexico as our neighbors. I found a recipe for blue cornbread stuffing with chorizo or sausage. Doesn't that sound good?
Boy, that sounds delicious, yeah. I also think up here in Phoenix, I almost feel like in some ways we lose our Southwest flavor, the bigger city we've gotten. It almost feels like Tucson has retained more of it. Do you find that to be in the foods as well?
I do. You know, Tucson is really focused a lot more, I think, on local. And we take from Baja, we take from New Mexico, and just our indigenous products and the Native Americans. So those are the three places that define Tucson eating. We're also cosmopolitan, but a lot of our flavor are those three ingredients.
Karen, I just had one more question for you. You did make reference to the possibility of putting something different in an apple pie. Is there anything that you can think of Southwestern that might give something with pumpkin a little bit more flair or other kinds of desserts we haven't talked about?
Well, chili actually goes well with chocolate, so that could possibly be a dark chocolate chili pie, like a Mexican hot chocolate.
Karen Zoldan has a food blog called Circle of Food. A Flagstaff crew has been working the wee hours of the morning in freezing temperatures to make enough snow to open Snowbowl tomorrow. This will be the Flagstaff Ski Resort's second full season with man-made snow. Getting the approval to make snow did not come easy. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laura Morales reports.
Last season was the second driest on record. Snowbowl's Jason Stratton says with the ability to make snow out of reclaimed wastewater, the resort was able to be open 122 days.
We estimated if we did not have snowmaking, we probably would have been open 7 to 10 days last year.
7 to 10, like a week?
Literally, week over Christmas, and that would have been it.
Stratton's old boss, Eric Borowski, just sold the resort after 23 years to James Coleman, who now owns three other resorts in the Southwest that rely on snowmaking. Borowski was determined to see snowmaking become a reality. He fought a decades-long legal battle against 13 Native American tribes that consider the mountain sacred. Clee Benally is an activist and member of the Navajo Nation.
It's something that worries me, you know, all the time when I, you know, pray or when I participate in ceremonies. I question the effectiveness of those prayers.
Benally also worries about the environmental impacts of pumping reclaimed wastewater up on the peaks. Biology professor Catherine Proper has studied animals exposed to the treated wastewater in her lab at Northern Arizona University.
And we have found that it looks like some component in the water, and we don't know what that is, might affect endocrine function. We do not know, though, how that translates into an environmental impact.
Proper says the findings might be different when exposed to ultraviolet rays and temperature change. Proper and the city's advisory panel concluded they didn't have enough data to support the hypothesis that human health would be affected. Still, Proper says she wouldn't encourage children eat the snow because more research needs to be done to learn exactly what's in there. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're at the show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. Happy Thanksgiving.